That's Heart from their debut album. Dreamboat Annie is the song. I'm thinking back to 1987, which is when I sort of jumped into the UFO topic, the first broadcast that I had done on it. And I started reading material as much as I could get my hands on to kind of get my head around the subject and figure out who's who and what's what and what's real and what isn't, what's credible and what isn't. And it didn't take very long of reading books at the time and journals from symposia and various other materials, including government documents, to see that this field was a mess. It was a mess then. It's a mess now. There is so much. My observation at the time was that there was so much infighting and turf wars, backbiting and backstabbing and a lot of nastiness in the field. And then a lot of charlatans, people peddling stuff that was pretty obviously untrue. You had, at the time, it was the MJ-12 controversy was in full bloom. It caused a lot of nasty debates. You had the alien abduction stuff was really coming into the forefront of ufology at the time. And a lot of the nuts and bolts saucer people were unwilling to go down that road. They found it offensive and unsupportable. You had dark conspiracy theories about secret treaties with aliens in exchange for the right to abduct people, as if aliens need our permission to abduct people. You had on the horizon was the whole disinformation scandal, the active participation of the Air Force personnel in stirring the pot and muddying the water. So it was a mess then. It's a mess now. And Robbie Graham, who I've had a chance to meet, we were at a conference together and we had him on our guest here in 2015, is a bright spot, I think, a really honest researcher and investigator who has written, he's spoken at a number of conferences around the world. He's written a previous book, Silver Screen Saucers, that sort of looks at the UFO mystery through the prism of movies and popular culture, which was a really refreshing departure from a lot of what you read in the field. Is going to join us in just a moment, and he is joined by Greg Bishop, who is well known to this program. We'll talk about his background in just a moment. But their project that they worked on together is UFOs reframing the debate, sort of trying to look at the mystery around UFOs and figure out what's wrong with it and maybe how to make it better, at least to make it more palatable and more credible to pursue this kind of research. We're going to hear what their ideas are when we come back here on Coast to Coast AM. Both of my guests for the remainder of the program are relatively young guys, at least young compared to me. Robbie Graham has spent more than half of his life so far researching this topic. Greg Bishop has been researching and writing about strange phenomena for more than 25 years. He sometimes is our webmaster here on Coast to Coast, but he's co-founded a magazine called The Excluded Middle, which is a journal of UFOs and conspiracy research and other topics. It's an entertaining read. And they both join me to talk about the new book, UFOs Reframing the Debate. Guys, good to have you here.
Hey, George.
Hey, George. Thanks very much.
Robbie, let's start with you. What did you hope to do with the book?
Well, I mean, as the title suggests, to literally sort of reframe the debate from a number of perspectives. It arose, I think, really out of mine and the contributors' collective frustration that what people call ufology is frankly broken, I think. And I think that it was never really fully assembled in the first place. I think we wanted to put together a book that would really lay bare many of the problems that do face the UFO study field. And these are the problems that it's always faced, really, since the 1940s, organizational, methodological, even ideological issues. And I wanted to shine a harsh light on these problems and, you know, because they're stumbling blocks, really, and I think we wanted to provide remedies and solutions so that we can move forward on a clearer path.
And same question to you, Greg. What did you hope to get done with this, or if you accomplish one thing with your participation in the book?
Well, I feel the same as Robbie. I also feel that while there are parts of the UFO subculture and ufology that really, you know, make me feel bad or annoy me or whatever, I also feel there's many parts of it that are good, you know, that do people some good, help them, give them something to do. It's a great mystery, and anybody can be involved in it. The problem is when people get involved and get in groups and all that, then politics and egos and all those things start getting in the way, and people can lose their way or lose their sight of what their purpose is. And I think part of the reason I wanted to be involved in this book was that there are a lot of ideas, theories, places that the UFO research could go that haven't really gone that far yet or haven't been taken to a point at which they would bear any fruit. And the people in the book suggest not only that we're kind of stuck, but also, more importantly, suggest positive and hopeful solutions and avenues of research, and that really excites me.
You know, Robbie, I guess part of the issue, it touches on something Greg just said, is ufology is big. I mean, and it's got a lot of different aspects to it. It's hard to get your head around what it really is. I mean, you've got, is ufology the MUFON and type groups, the organized groups? Is it the authors, the names that are of the stars in the field who are best known, who sell these books and lots of copies? Is it the charlatans who inhabit the space, who, you know, there's a couple of online organizations that seem to peddle these made-up stories. They make up videos. They peddle them to media people who send them all out because they know it gets a lot of clicks, even though they're completely bogus. It's hard to, you know, it's a very democratic endeavor. So it's hard to say who's a ufologist and who isn't, or what ufology is and what it isn't, right?
Correct. Well, I think for better or for worse, ufology is today all of the things you just mentioned, which is precisely why it is such a mess. I think in the opening paragraph of the book, I tried to shatter the myth that there is such a thing even as ufology in any meaningful sense of the term. You know, if ology refers to a branch of knowledge or learning sprung from organized research, then ufology is a broken twig. And so we can call ourselves ufologists, but it doesn't really carry much weight. If there is an underlying ontological reality behind the UFO enigma, we haven't approached it from, I think, any useful angles at this point. We haven't really borne any fruit from our investigations over the past 60 or 70 years. We don't fundamentally know any more about the underlying nature of the phenomenon today than we knew back in 1947. What we have had over the past 70 years is this blooming of a rich mythology. And so ufology is more mythology than anything else, I would say. And so this book is about cutting through that and seeing, you know, how we can approach this from it's not necessarily more practical angles. The book is both practical and theoretical, but it's sort of suggesting that we might be able to ask some more meaningful questions, really, and trying to put aside long cherished beliefs and assumptions, really. And so the book is really, it's a collection of original essays, and they explore, I guess you could say, alternative perspectives on UFOs and how we might more usefully study the phenomenon today. And it's I describe it as a cold hard slap in the face for so-called ufology, but it's delivered with love. All of the people who have written for the book are passionate about the subject. They just have ideas that are not necessarily embraced by, you know, your typical MUFON conference, I guess. It's an effort to tread a new path in quest of understanding what we do consider, or at least most of the contributors consider, to be a genuine anomalous enigma. It's really intended to challenge the reader, regardless of whether the reader is a skeptical believer, for lack of more nuanced terms. And it's intended to make you feel uncomfortable. It's intended to make you feel irritated, but also excited and intrigued. It's intended to make you think differently and to cast aside, as I say, cherished beliefs, comfortable assumptions. And I think we succeed to an extent in that. I think, you know, many of the ideas that we present are not necessarily new. But in this age of exopolitics and disclosure, in this age of crystallized ufological mythology, many of the ideas that we present are, I would say, misunderstood, overlooked, or forgotten. And we present them with fresh perspective, and yes, we do offer new ideas too, but I think that the new theories to account for aspects for UFOs are essential at this point.
Well, it's a great read, and you've assembled a great group of writers, smart people with good ideas and insight. I forget where the phrase was used, but it was subversive insight is one of the descriptions of what's in the book. And it certainly is that, and that's one of my favorite words. Greg, again and again throughout the book that you guys have written, the idea of the extraterrestrial hypothesis, the ETH being the dominant paradigm, is assailed. And I know that it was the dominant paradigm when I jumped into this. I guess it still is. But it seems like over the last 30 years that a lot of other ideas have at least seeped into the outer edges of what we would call ufology. Would you agree?
Oh, yeah, it very much has. But as my late friend Mac Tonies used to say, that the ETH, the idea of aliens, is kind of a delicious idea to everybody. It flatters all our prejudices. I would point out that the people in this book are not what you would call skeptics or even hostile to the idea of aliens or non-human intelligence. They just say we've been looking at it in one way. We should try looking at it in different ways. And more importantly, I think two other real important threads in the book. One of them is that we should look at how we look at things and how we think about things and how we tell each other stories and how we communicate with each other and how how witnesses witness things. And the other one is that the witness is important. In fact, that's the title of one of the chapters.
Well, it's sort of one of the themes of what you explore and what you wrote is, and you put it this way, is how much do we bring to the dance? During a paranormal encounter, a UFO encounter, alien encounter, or a broader definition of a paranormal, how much of it is a result of our subconscious sort of framing how we interpret the events that happen to us, right?
Yeah, I think that's very important. The other thread that I said, I'll get back to that point, but the other thread I said was that, and this is becoming important in ufology, I noticed this with a lot of researchers, that they think that they are thinking at this point, we should really listen to the witness and what they have to say. We shouldn't start throwing things away that don't sound right or can't be put in a category or can't be, isn't something that we've heard before. You know, these things are all important. And from my point of view, to answer your question, I think we have to really examine what I said in my essay is we have to really examine how we see things, how our nervous system processes input, how our visual system processes input, how we react during a traumatic event, which is basically if you're seeing something strange like a UFO or aliens or whatever you're perceiving, that's a traumatic event. And your mind operates in a completely different way than it does in normal waking, resting, not threatened consciousness. And all these factors have been, I think, pretty much ignored. We're not video recorders. We're not tape recorders. We interpret our information evolutionarily based on how it can help us survive. And I think that part of the witness equation hasn't been looked at. We tend to think of the witness as, like I said, a video or a tape recorder, and human beings are not like that. They're thinking, feeling, and interpreting beings.
Well, I would take it a step further. I mean, your idea that how we describe these things often is a reflection of our subconscious and how we make sense of it. And we can get into this during the program, but it might also be the phenomena incorporating our subconscious and playing with the idea of how we interpret things.
Yeah, it could be. I mean, the one line I wrote in my essay somewhere is, are we dealing with something that holds up a mirror to us when we get too close? I think that's an important thing to consider. I mean, how much are we looking at ourselves when something very strange happens to us? And how much, we have to pull it through all our filters. I don't know where it's coming from. It's coming from somewhere. I really do believe there's an external, if you want to call that, reality to a UFO encounter. But I don't know exactly what that is, and I think we've made way too many assumptions about what it might be. So I'm trying to peel back the layers and see what's left there when we take our perceptions out. Is there something left? And if there is something left, how much of it is mixed with our perceptions and our expectations and our wishes and our retelling of a story and an interaction with a UFO researcher who has their own agenda, too?
So that's I want to definitely come back to that when we discuss sort of the ridiculous factor, how ridiculous some of these things are. The high strangeness as a result of being I haven't heard this before. Let's just toss it out, as you mentioned. But before we leave this section, you know, the perception, Robbie, of ufology as being the extraterrestrial hypothesis, the dominant sort of paradigm, that's ufology, mainstream ufology's fault to a degree. But it's also sort of in your area of expertise from Hollywood and pop culture. That idea that these are space aliens coming from other planets, that's been pounded into us over 50, 60 years of movies and TV.
Yeah, the ETH has natural appeal, and on one level does have considerable natural logic, I guess. But at the same time, it's incredibly simplistic when applied to the grassroots UFO reports that have been gathered over 70 years. None of us in this book rule out the ETH, and I still think it's credible to a degree. But what I'm saying is that it doesn't seem to go far enough to account for the full spectrum of weirdness that's represented in UFO reports. We may be dealing with something far more bizarre than extraterrestrial visitation, or perhaps not at all. But yes, certainly Hollywood likes to keep things simple, and alien visitation works on a narrative level. And so Hollywood's projection of this idea of alien visitation has certainly concretized the popular notion that we are being visited by aliens, and that the UFO phenomenon is directly tied to alien visitation. Absolutely.
Moved by how often there are references in the book, each of your writers, and I forget what the total number is, but so many of them reference Jacques Vallée. And my opinion about his work is no secret here. He's influenced my own take on this topic. But a lot of these writers, your group, they're younger writers, they picked up on it and built on it. And I think that's a positive development. We can get into details in a minute. But was that on purpose on your part of you and Greg?
No, that was just I had no idea how many times or if Jacques would be mentioned at all. I think there's probably about 48 or more mentions of Jacques Vallée throughout the book. Every writer mentions him at one point, each using a different quote from Jacques.
I was really embarrassed that I didn't when I realized.
Okay, Greg did. this is certainly not a Jacques Vallée book, but certainly his influence is felt, I think. But it's strange, because if you were to read just this book, you would think that Jacques Vallée's ideas have formed popular ufological beliefs. But actually, that's not the case. In one way, he is incredibly influential, but his ideas are incredibly sophisticated, and to be honest, they struggle to find a foothold in what we would term popular ufology today, because it is so simplistic. And it's built around today that, you know, ufology is built around this notion of exopolitics, that it's taken as a given that we are being visited by a number of alien civilizations, that the governments know this, that there are, as you mentioned in the introduction, George, treaties between humans and aliens. And it's this very dense, rich ufological narrative mythology that's emerged over the past several decades, enforced by Hollywood as a natural cultural process, and also perhaps from a conspiratorial perspective as well, as I explore in Silver Screen Sources. But what we have is this big mess, but it's a very appealing mess, and it shuts out more nuanced and subtle ideas and approaches. And so a lot of people today, I think, who, if you're coming fresh to the UFO field, you encounter books that sell you a particular idea that's very easy to digest, and it relates to those things that I've just mentioned. But when if you're looking at Jacques Vallée's work, it's far harder to get your head around, which probably indicates it's probably worth your time. And so a lot of the people in this book do at times reference his work, but again, they do so with fresh eyes.
Yeah, I'll tell you what, we'll come back to that, because in a way, all the writers, Jacques Vallée has been you guys at various points of his career. We're talking with Robbie Graham and Greg Bishop about the new book, UFOs, Reframing the Debate. We'll be right back. Quirky little ukulele tune from Paul McCartney. Back when he was a Beatle, McCartney would often use the pseudonym Paul Ramone when he'd register at hotels. I don't know if that's the inspiration for this song called Ram On, spelled the same way as Paul Ramone, but it is from my favorite McCartney solo album, Ram, and I think Greg Bishop's favorite as well. We're talking with Greg Bishop and Robbie Graham about the new book, UFOs, Reframing the Debate. In a moment, we jump into some of the controversial and pointed suggestions that are made in this book, and it's a lot to chew on. We'll be right back. I was mentioning before the break about Jacques Vallée, and I know that in my own learning curve about UFOs, it was sort of a turning point for me regarding the extraterrestrial hypothesis as being the dominant paradigm or the only explanation for the things that people are seeing and encountering. Vallée's two books, Messengers of Deception and Passport to Magonia, sort of took care of that for me. That opened up a much broader perspective, and it sounds like, based on what I read in the book, that it's the same way for several of the writers, and mostly younger writers, younger than me anyway. But at one point, as I was trying to say in that before the break, at one point in his career, Jacques Vallée was just like you guys, in that he was taking on the establishment, knocking down the predominant paradigm of his times and trying to explain, look, there are broader perspectives on this. I suppose, Robbie, it has occurred to you that you're following somewhat in the same path.
It hadn't actually until you mentioned it. But I mean, we'd be honored to think of ourselves, you know, in the same breath as Jacques Vallée. I guess we are expecting harsh criticism from certain quarters in the UFO community with what we put out here. I think some people, a good number of people, hopefully, will embrace it, but it will divide opinion and it will make people uncomfortable. And that was the goal all along. It was intended to be a challenge. We want people to to question what it is that they truly believe, and belief is a theme throughout this book. You can't talk about UFOs without talking about belief, because when we come to the actual underlying nature of the phenomenon, whatever it might represent, all we have really, in the absence of any hard facts, is belief on one level or another. And so when you sort of do address the fact that belief plays a huge part in all of this, then we really have to start. It really kind of forces an individual to question just what is left beyond belief, and that's one of the themes of the book. It's not the dominant theme of the book, but it's a continuous thread throughout the essays, I would say. I mean, what do you think about that, Greg?
Yeah, as far as Vallée is concerned, yeah, he's kind of a motif throughout the book, because he basically, like George said, once you encounter some of his ideas, you realize that this field is a lot more varied and there's a lot bigger spectrum than you realized before that you have to consider. We don't jump completely into it and say there's nothing to it, and Vallée doesn't either. But his idea is that, look, we have to look at the history of what people have seen that is strange, how they described it, and how that's being described now, and how those things might be similar. So a lot of the writers in the book take off from that idea, and others of Vallée's, and a few other people too, and expand upon them. I think that's a good thing. You stand on the shoulders of giants that came before you, and definitely that's what people are doing in this book.
I don't know which of you edited which chapters, so I'm going to touch on some of the stuff that I found really compelling in the book. I don't know how I pronounce it. Is it Mark Cleland or Cleland?
Oh, Mike Cleland.
Mike Cleland. That was a unique chapter and essay, because he's not only writing about this, he is an experiencer, and he's telling the story from the viewpoint of an experiencer. And I found a couple of things that he wrote compelling, him talking about the need to be taken seriously versus the need to be honest. And that is a challenge in the field, when you especially get into the cases of high strangeness, right?
That's right, yeah. I mean, to clarify as well, that, you know, people who are just tuning into this might be thinking, oh, this sounds like an incredibly skeptical book, and it is from one perspective. But at the same time, as I say, most of the contributors in this volume are completely open to there being some kind of a genuinely anomalous enigma underlying UFOs, but we are skeptical of almost all aspects of ufology and of many of the approaches that ufology has adopted over the years, because many of them have proved to be largely fruitless. The foreword for this book was written by Professor Diana Walsh-Pasolka, who's the chair of the Department of Religion and Philosophy and Religion at North Carolina University in Wilmington. And she, in her foreword, she says, the beauty of this volume is that it brings together both nuts and bolts materialists and those who favor more oblique approaches. She says, unusually and refreshingly, it represents both objective observers of the UFO conundrum and subjective experiences of it. She says the combination of these perspectives is necessary to better understand the phenomena. And I think that really sums up the book in a way. I was keen to get people in this book who were talking from a purely subjective perspective. Someone like Mike Clellan, for example. We have other contributors in the book, at least another two or three, who would consider themselves experiences or at least close-up UFO witnesses. So this is not a piece of debunkery by any means. It's intended to present perspectives from what you would term believers, and then people who are much more hardline skeptics, people who adopt materialist approaches, and people who kind of see limitations in those approaches. And I've placed the essays, to the extent that is possible, back to back in a conflicting manner, so that the reader never really feels comfortable. Just as you feel at the end of one essay that you might be reaching a conclusion about something underlying the phenomenon, you read the next essay and all of those assumptions are then shattered. And that's the point. And at the end of the book, I want the reader to feel lost, essentially, because when you're lost, you start to ask questions and then you start to look for a new direction.
Greg, the idea of UFOs as representing and paranormal experiences representing something other than extraterrestrials visiting the planet is a theme that you have explored as well in your writings and have been pretty open about. Mike Clellan, in that chapter, is talking about the need to be taken seriously versus the urge to be honest, which is a very real issue in this field, because the weirder the experience, the less likely you are to want to talk about it and be open about it, right?
Yeah, that's true. The reason I like Mike's essay is for the very reason you said in the quote you had. He wants to be taken seriously, but he doesn't want to cover up parts of his experience and those of others he's talked to, because he is a researcher too, to make it sound better or to streamline it or to be respectable or whatever. These things are those ideas, I think, hurt the study of UFOs. And the fact that he mentions this in his essay, also Robert Brandstetter mentions this in his essay, and a couple of the other writers too, the fact that you should listen to everything that a witness says, and if you want to come out and say, public about what you're doing, be honest about it. If people don't like what you're saying, well, then that's too bad. Mike's attitude is perfect. He says exactly what's happened to him, and he has no real ego attached to it where he's saying, I'm right and you're wrong, or I'm special and you're not, or anything like that. He's genuinely perplexed about what's happened to him, and he's trying to find answers by communicating this to other people and maybe looking for an explanation or some kind of peace in sharing it with people and hearing what they have to say. And I think that's very important, too. Obviously, there are people that say, completely crazy things, which is fine. I think, the main problem is, like I said, this ego thing. If your ego gets in the way and you think you're more important than other people, or my story is so significant, or whatever, the humility, if there's no humility there, it becomes less, I think, I don't know if it becomes less authentic, but it's easier for people to accept what you're saying if you don't push it at them or shove it down their throat or tell them that you're right, if you understand what I'm saying.
I do. There was another, I really liked the red pill junkie thing on anarchy because, the cases of unnecessary absurdity that are discussed, because it's a theme that I've explored as well. And he gets into Magonia, the Voronezh alien landing in Russia in 1989. I remember CBS News reporting on that, and they're sort of scoffing at it. These giant robotic type aliens that land and they melt the asphalt, and CBS is kind of laughing about it, like, that's not what aliens look like. We know what aliens look like. It was just absurd. I think about, Greg, the Men in Black cases that you've written about before, and then even Skinwalker Ranch. Some of these things are so absurd to the point where they look like they're absurd on purpose to test the limits of what we can believe, and they become a challenge for the witnesses because they don't want to report it. I know that in writing about the ranch that we had to discuss about one of the incidents with the smoking dogs, gosh, do we put this thing in? It's going to sound pretty ridiculous. Dogs in trench coats smoking cigarettes, but we did, you know. And you have to, as the red pill junkie says, you have to let it all hang out, kind of thing.
Well, you have to be honest with yourself and other people. And if you are, it doesn't, like I said, it doesn't really matter what people think. If you're being honest, you have nothing to hide. Nobody has anything on you. They can't impugn you except to say that what you say sounds crazy. But if you know you're not crazy, and other people have had similar experiences, strange experiences, completely outlandish experiences, know that you're not crazy either, because just as crazy stuff has happened to them. And I think a lot of the gold, I guess, or the fruit, or whatever you want to call it, lies in these very strange experiences and the remembrances of them, and how people may integrate them into their lives too, because some of these things change people's lives considerably. Their marriages fall apart, they lose their jobs, all their friends disappear, they start a religion. All these things, people don't really pay too much attention to this in the study of this, and it's very important, I think, to look at the human angle and how people are affected. That's a very important part of the equation. I think people should be talked to days, weeks, months after they've been first interviewed to see what's happened in their lives and what they think of what's happened to them. I think some really good insights could be derived from that type of study.
Robbie, I'm thinking about the movie Close Encounters and the Francois Truffaut character who says it is an event sociological. And that theme comes up in your book several times, is the sociological impact, whether no matter what the event is or what the source of it is, extraterrestrial, interdimensional, poltergeist, whatever it is, that it's worth studying. And it's something that can be studied if people are willing to dive into it.
It can be, yeah, and in Diana's foreword for the book, she focuses on this idea that regardless of what underlies the UFO phenomenon, what we can measure is its cultural and societal effects over time, and perhaps by measuring those effects and studying those effects, we can actually learn more about whatever the phenomenon itself might represent. So it's an oblique approach to it. So the actual phenomenon itself, as we know, proves to be incredibly elusive. Almost tricksterish, which is a theme in this book as well. But what we can clearly see is how it forms beliefs and how it creates subcultures and mythologies, and that tells us more about ourselves as individuals and as a species, as a social species, than it does perhaps about the phenomenon. So there is much to be learned about the UFO phenomenon, but perhaps we're looking in the wrong place. Perhaps we need to focus the attention on ourselves a little bit more, and then in time, perhaps that can reveal something about a greater truth that
may be
out there.
There are religious themes throughout, and rightfully so. I knew you guys were trying to stir the pot when I read the title of one of the early chapters, Our Alien Who Art in Heaven. That was going to generate a response. That's Chris Rutkowski, who says that modern ufology has rejected science in favor of more mystical and religious view. And I don't know which ufology that is, because there's a lot of ufologists who do try to follow a scientific model. But as different writers in this book explore, there has to be something maybe more flexible than just that model.
I think everyone has a slightly different interpretation of what ufology represents, but I think generally when we talk about ufology, I think we're really talking about popular ufology as represented by some of the most popular and well-attended conferences, for example, in the United States, which is the hub of the global UFO community. If you look at some of the best-selling books on the phenomenon, what you have increasingly is pervasive ideas surrounding. Well, it's less a science and more of a mythos now. So you for example, you have a conference coming up or just gone about a MUFON conference, and MUFON's supposed to be a scientific organization. It's about the secret space program, and almost all of the speakers there are talking about things which have absolutely no foundation in science whatsoever. You know, if you look at things like Contact in the Desert, or even, I won't even name some of the other massive conferences, a lot of the speakers who are there are talking about the phenomenon from anything but scientific angles. Now, that's, you know, some of the contributors to this book will say that's fine, because rigid science actually has had very limited success in unraveling the mystery. So you do have, for example, people like Chris Rutkowski in our book, and for example, Jack Brewer and others who really come down very hard on anything but a traditionally scientific approach to the subject. Whereas others, for example, like Joshua Kutchin, suggest that, you know, the phenomenon is anti-materialist, and we need to look beyond current scientific methodologies to unravel its secrets. And so that's what I say. You have this continuing conflict between the essays, between the perspectives in the book, and it's intended to encourage the reader to really question what it is they actually feel comfortable with accepting and believing about the subject, so that by the end of it, they really don't know what to believe. And I think, if anything, you're not meant to believe anything. We don't want you to believe anything. We want you to keep an open mind, to be agnostic, ask lots and lots of questions, and if you do reach a conclusion, hold it very lightly in the acceptance that letting go of it is not a bad thing.
That's a hard question to answer, isn't it, Greg, when somebody knows you write about UFOs or something and they just approach you, well, do you believe this stuff is true? Do you believe in UFOs? Which, you know, I always regarded it as a news story, something I was pursuing to try to figure out, not a belief system, not my religion. But religion, that theme and the zealous nature of religious beliefs pops up again and again in the book you guys have produced.
Yeah, there's. I will clarify. Robbie was the editor. I basically kind of helped him as a sub-editor, I would suppose, you know, went through the essays with him, pointed out things that he had basically had the final say, because it was his idea. But I've always had this problem when somebody walks up to me and says, "Do you believe in UFOs?" And it took me a long time to come to some sort of answer I could give to people without having to explain to them how I came to, you know, what my opinion is at present. It's always changing. You know, it's changed over the years, and I'm happy that it's changed. But my answer is usually, I believe something interacts with us occasionally that's not us. That's as far as I can take it right now. And I think majority of the people in the book would kind of say the same thing. There is something really going on. There is something that probably is not us.
You called it extra human consciousness, right?
Yeah, exactly. It's a consciousness. It can think. It can do things. And it occasionally interacts with us, and I don't know why it does it. Maybe it does it because it wants to, you know, it wants to more affirm what it is. You know, kind of, I said the idea that God created things, recreated the universe to experience what not being God was like. There may be something similar going on with some sort of non-human or extra-human consciousness or intelligence, whereby, you know, the only way that they can realize that we're here and interact with us is to have these very strange interactions that just totally freak us out. And maybe it freaks them out, too. I have no idea. But I truly do believe there's some other thing that besides us that interacts with us. But making a conclusion or some sort of statement beyond that, I think is premature, especially if you say that I'm right and you're wrong, and you must understand it in the way that I do, because
right.
I don't. The history of the subject shows that you can interpret it so many different ways and have it be almost equally valid.
We're talking with Greg Bishop and Robbie Graham about UFOs, reframing the debate. We'll get into some specific suggestions in the next hour and save some time for your calls and comments and questions. David Gray takes us into the break. Babylon.